wire, and it suddenly, given the circumstance in Japan, became a timely opportunity to discuss an obligation to discuss certain issues. I very much want to thank a lot of people that are here today and thank the Chairman of Public Safety for joining us today. I would anticipate that there will be subsequent meetings, perhaps with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, with FEMA, with SEMA, our state people, with perhaps other legislators, others, to continue this due diligence process. As the host county for the nuclear power plants, we have an obligation, we have an opportunity. There is no reason and there is no interest on the part of any of us to panic or, in fact, to act in haste. Instead, it's a chance to ask questions, to get answers, and to see what lessons can be learned from what's occurring and what changes can be made to effectuate what we're all concerned about, ultimately, primarily and secondarily, and for every mode is public safety, because that's our job, is to make sure that people are safe. Jerry Shapiro's here, a regional director of Senator Gillibrand. Joe Donnett, district representative from Representative Nita Lowy, is here. Many citizens are here, and we've heard from many elected officials as well. So I'll turn it over to you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And, gentlemen, welcome. And I know you've been given a sort of a broad mandate to cover a lot of areas, and we appreciate you being here today. I just want to make sure that you specifically cover a couple of areas, and I'll just listen briefly and then we'll turn it over to you. The containment structure, just comment that in terms of its design and where the comfort level in terms of seismic activity. Spent fuel storage, it's my understanding that at least at Indian Point, we've started the process of going from the storage pools to dry casket, which is a big difference than the Japanese situation, so I'd like you to comment on where we are in that process. The backup electrical systems, again, because a lot of people have seen on the news that seems to be a major issue with the tsunami. I'd like you to comment on the electrical backup systems at Indian Point, because again, it's my understanding you have certain capabilities by design that are not in the Japanese situation that really be very beneficial if, God forbid, something happens. So I want to make sure you touch on that, because as the Chairman Kaplan had said, this is information gathering. It's an opportunity to educate the public, give them an understanding of what the facts are. So on the backup electrical systems, explain the steam and everything you have going there. The safety analysis, I think you announced or pursuant to a request from the governor that you're going to be doing a safety analysis. And I assume that's going to cover both the operation of the plant and the impact of earthquakes on both plant operation and evacuation plans. And then the geological formations, if you just touch briefly on the differences, as you understand it, between what's going on in Japan, that geological formation, the geological formation here, and how likely would it be that we have a similar situation as Japan. So if you can touch on those, I think that'd be helpful.
What, 1 minute or less, 30 words would be... why don't we introduce our fine guests?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. We appreciate the opportunity to come before these joint committee and provide information to the public. My name is Kenneth Theobalds. I'm the Vice President for Government and Regulatory Affairs for Entergy. We're the owners and operators of Indian Point. I'm joined here by my esteemed colleagues, subject matter experts, Mr. Michael Slobodin, who's the Director of Emergency Planning, and Mr. John McCann, who's Vice President for
Nuclear Safety, Licensing, and Emergency Planning.
John has the biggest portfolio of any vice president at Entergy, but that is because of his quite extensive experience and capabilities. So again, we thank the committee for the opportunity to present information. I believe we will be able to cover most of the information that you've asked us to provide to the extent that we have knowledge and factual information to provide. We will not enter into a lot of speculation. We're really going to stay within the balance of the plant's capabilities, design, and our understanding and our detailed knowledge of our systems.
Okay. Okay. Can't hear, so if you could do a lot of... Yep. Just as a practical matter, why don't we, if you gentlemen would have whatever statements you'd like to make, we will not ask questions or interrupt, of course. And then if you'd be willing, we'd like to have some healthy discussion and Q&A if that is appropriate. Great. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, again, my name is John McCann, and I certainly appreciate the opportunity to be here today and provide yourself and members of the legislature and, of course, the members of the public that are in attendance our perspectives and insights as to the tragic events that are unfolding in Japan. You know, in terms of a human tragedy, it is certainly something that I think all of us per se will never forget. It's probably a unique event in our lifetime. That being said, you know, first of all, I will appreciate the comments that you made that we need to be careful about not moving too quickly. At the very least, I would say, you know, our understanding of the facts of exactly what happened in Japan, the details associated with that, are probably in many ways not much better than yours. In terms of the absolute details associated with the information. So I'll touch at a kind of high level of what we believe we know about what happened in Japan. I will kind of do mostly what you suggested here and draw a few comparisons between the Japanese situation and the specific situation at Indian Point, again highlighting maybe some concerns around the seismic issue, power supplies, etc. So, you know, the six reactors experienced an earthquake of a magnitude 9 on the Richter scale, followed by a tsunami. Those events in themselves are astounding, I suppose. A 9 earthquake followed by a 30-foot wall of water. As you know, the Indian Point units 1, 2, and 3, the units at Fukushima 1, 2, and 3 did shut down automatically as required. That basically terminates the fission process, but it doesn't deal with what we call the decay heat. In other words, when you turn the reactor off, there is still heat in the fuel that will continue to be an issue that has to be dealt with for some time. They also had a sustained loss of normal and backup AC emergency power. And again, it's preliminary information, but our understanding is that their emergency diesel generators, immediately following the earthquake, started and loaded as required. So what does that mean? If it's preliminary, but if it were only the earthquake that they had to deal with, we probably wouldn't be discussing this event here today. What became the much more significant problem, however, was the tsunami that followed. And that tsunami not only flooded the emergency diesel generator equipment, but apparently some of the switchgear, which is the circuit breakers and switches needed to move the power, and the fuel supply to be able to power those emergency diesel generators. So that put them in a situation for all units where they really had what we would call station blackout conditions, where no electrical power available. We know that fuel rods were uncovered in the reactors in units 1, 2, and 3. We believe that the fuel rods in the unit 4 spent fuel pool were also uncovered, and I think there's some speculation, which I can't confirm or deny, as to whether the same thing might have happened with spent fuel rods in their spent fuel for reactor unit 3. As you know, they had some hydrogen gas that was released as a result of core damage, and this resulted in explosions at several of the units while they tried to vent that off. They subsequently used seawater to flood the core and provide cooling, and that is, I believe, the condition in the plants now. Those units are in what we call cold shutdown, which is a depressurized and cooled condition. So let me hit on some design features that may be important here. First of all, for Indian Point, our plants are designed with a margin, meaning a safety factor or additional margin, to withstand what's called an earthquake of intensity Mercalli 7. And that is kind of comparable. They measure slightly different things. One measures a tendency towards damage. The other just measures an absolute, you know, shaking of the earth. Richter measures the same shaking of the earth, and that was like a magnitude 6 on the Richter scale. That magnitude is, in fact, greater than any that has ever seen or been experienced historically in our location. All the plant structures and components that are important to safe shutdown at Indian Point are designed to be able to withstand that design basis earthquake. I would say categorically that Indian Point is not susceptible to the type of earthquake that occurred in Japan, and more importantly perhaps to the tsunami, which became the fundamental damaging agent to their safe shutdown capability. And this is doing part, at least, the seismology and geology of our area. So I'm not an earthquake expert by any means, but it is my understanding that a series of northeast trending faults, the faults that were tended to east to west and west to east, known collectively as the Ramapo Fault System, is the seismic condition that the Indian Point plants are in. The largest reported earthquake in the Hudson Valley occurred, I believe, in Rockland County in 1951, with a magnitude of 3.6 on the Richter scale. Now, to give you a sense, these earthquake scales are logarithmic, which means a number 7 is 10 times bigger than a number 6, and number 8 is 1,000 times bigger than a number 6. In other words, each one is another multiple of 10. So to put that in perspective, the earthquake in Japan was essentially 1,000 times greater than the earthquake that we were designed for. So I won't go too much into seismology here, because again, I'm not an earthquake expert, but let me talk a little bit about tsunami. Tsunami is essentially a coastal phenomenon. So the fact that Indian Point is so far inland means that tsunami is not a credible mechanism for damage at Indian Point. But you would say, well, okay, what about flooding? And I'll just tell you that the plan is required to be designed for all natural phenomena. So we have conditions that apply to tornadoes, to hurricanes, to earthquake, and to flooding. And the approach to flooding is we will design for what's called the 100-year flood, plus margin. So you look at the worst historical flood that has ever occurred in 100 years worth of reported history, and then you add a margin to that. And I forget exactly what the name of the dam is that is assumed to break, but it does include things like the dam break in terms of how high the Hudson River will come. And again, we're required to have equipment important to safety protected from that potential worst flood. You asked me to touch briefly on equipment capabilities. It's essential, I think, to think in terms of American design and actually worldwide design for nuclear power plants in terms of a concept we call defense in depth. And fundamentally what that means is that our systems are designed with redundant or multiple ways of accomplishing a task, multiple pieces of equipment that do the same thing, and diversity, with diverse ways of performing a function. So that is what the systems are designed to be able to do for all of these credible, for all natural phenomena that I talked about, as well as sort of man-made incidents that could affect the operation of the facility. So, for instance, let me give you a sense about AC power, although this concept would apply to pretty much all of the key design features, of which AC power is just one. So, first of all, Indian Point is blessed in some ways of being in the Con Edison, New York metropolitan electrical distribution area. So what that means is, in terms of ways of getting electricity to Indian Point, for all the reasons that we have a lot of electric power and a lot of electric power reliability in the New York area, there are a lot of ways to get power to Indian Point. 13.8 kV power, 138 kV power coming in from multiple paths to what we call the Buchanan Switchyard, which is owned by Con Edison and manned 24 hours a day. Among other things, because of the importance of that switchyard to Indian Point. But in the event that we did lose AC power due to a natural disaster from offsite, the first line of defense would be what we call our emergency diesel generators. And at each of our units, again, designed for earthquake, tornado, flooding, we have three big diesel generators, of which two are required to be able to accomplish not only a safe shutdown under normal circumstances, but they say shut down under accident circumstances, such as a loss of cooling accident or something like that. If for some reason, and by the way, these are all above grade, and just to put it in perspective for you, you know, the tsunami took out those diesels, among other things, apparently, again, because we don't know all the details, because that equipment in Japan was below grade, so it flooded. The rooms that they were in were flooded. And the tanks that supplied the fuel oil for those diesel generators were kind of washed away by the tsunami. So that's a fundamental difference that's probably worth noting. Additionally, just to put that in perspective, we're required by our license to have fuel available for those diesel generators for at least 7 days, and we typically have an inventory of 14 days worth of fuel on-site available for those generators. If for some reason those generators were to fail, however, NRC requires that all nuclear plants be able to deal with station blackout conditions to be able to conduct a safe shutdown. So we have at each site another diesel generator, separate both electrically and physically from the six that I talked about already, that is its sole function is to provide the necessary power to shut down the unit safely. And we'll talk a little bit in a moment about the type of systems that we would use to do that. The last line of defense is a relatively new one in a formal way. We have what we call them the SAMGs, who are severe accident management guidelines. These are procedures that are in place that are operators trained to, that go way beyond the design basis into, frankly, the types of activities that we are seeing the Japanese perform at Fukushima. And then even going beyond that, I think one of the lessons that we had from our experience on 9/11 is that, you know, if you consider man intentionally caused incidents in a facility, in some ways, you know, they may be more challenging than even the worst that nature can offer. So in response to 9/11, the NRC issued an order, I believe in 2002, that required us to put in place certain way beyond design basis capabilities. So what this would mean is things like staging backup pumps that are not at all part of the normal facility, diesel-driven, gasoline-driven, making sure that we have the hoses, the connections, the fittings that we walk through, how we would make the connections to the river if we had to be able to use this sort of ultimate disaster capability to do really, really three things. The first thing is, you know, the primary rule for nuclear guys is to keep the core covered. So the first function would be able to provide water to the reactor coolant system such that we would keep the reactor core in the reactor itself cool. The second fundamental function that is paramount, as it be seen perhaps in the Japanese situation, is to keep the spent fuel covered. So these strategies also focus on being able to bring water to the spent fuel pools. And the third, and perhaps in many ways most important element of this strategy, is to protect the containment. So let me now go to, I think, maybe another question that you asked me to talk about here, which is the difference in containment design, maybe a little bit about the Indian Point containment design. So fundamentally, a big difference between the Japanese reactors at Fukushima and Indian Point is in design. Indian Point is a pressurized water reactor. The Fukushima reactor was a boiling water reactor, happens to be of the Mark I containment design. And there are several containment designs in use in the industry. So the way the reactor is cooled at Indian Point involves the steam generators. And some people may recall from the various drills that we've had over time that there are four steam generators at Indian Point. They provide a way of taking the heat from the reactor coolant system to make steam, to turn the turbine, to make the electricity, but separate that steam from the primary water through tubes. So you have tubes that run through the steam generators from the reactor coolant system, transfer the heat. The way you cool down a pressurized water reactor that's been operating at power is basically to steam those steam generators. In other words, you put water in the steam generator, the energy leaves the steam generator in the form of steam. It's not contaminated steam now, but remember it's separated from the primary system by the tubes in the steam generator. So the challenge in a loss of power situation is how do we ensure that heat sink remains intact? And fundamentally, we feed the steam generators with three pumps. We have two electric feed pumps, auxiliary feed water pumps, we call them, that we would have to assume in this situation would not have power. So in the blackout situation, there is also a turbine-driven or steam-driven a feed pump. So what would happen in this situation if there were no electrical power? The steam from the steam generator would be used to drive the turbine-driven pump, which would pump the water to the steam generators to continue to perform the cooling function. So you say, well, okay, where does the water come from? The condensate storage tank, which is where the water for the steam generators would normally be drawn, is designed to be able to achieve cold shutdown, and that's approximately a 24-hour evolution. So there's enough water there, we had no potential to make up, to be able to achieve cold shutdown. Beyond that, Indian Point, not all stations are designed this way, but Indian Point is designed such that we can take a suction from city water. And we have a city water tank on site of over a million gallons capacity, which would give us at least another 4 days. To be able to cool via that mechanism, or the sort of normal mechanism for station blackout. And we would be going down that path long before we got into the more exotic SAMG or post 9/11 cooling capabilities. I'm not sure. Have I?
Can you address the dry casket, storage, disposed fuel? That's what I think. Dry casket.
We do have dry casket storage. Yes. Here's a better one. Just to see. We do have an independent spent fuel storage installation at Indian Point that we would be able to use for dry cask storage. So what that means is that as we operate the reactor over time, we would eventually run out of room in this bad fuel pool for the fuel loads that we use over the years. So as time goes on, because as everyone knows, we have not developed Yucca Mountain as the final repository for fuel. Originally it was planned that the Department of Energy would long ago have been taking the fuel from the site. All of us in the industry more or less have had to come up with a plan B, which is the independent spent fuel storage capability where we take the fuel out of the pool, put it into casks that are specifically designed for this purpose and store them on a concrete pad until such time as the Department of Energy is eventually willing to take the fuel. So we have that capability. I think that being said, there's generally pretty much always going to be fuel in the spent fuel pools. In other words, you can't just take it immediately out of the spent fuel pool and put it in the dry storage. So we will have to continue to plan for having spent fuel in the spent fuel pool and mitigating any problems there, as
but,
we do.
But can you describe, I thought you started the process of taking spent fuel rods out and putting them in dry storage. I mean, hasn't that already...
We have. I think the point I'm trying to make, it may be not
because
well.
Because once it happens, it's too late to do it after the fact. So I'm saying, so right now, today, let me ask you, today, on site today, how much of your spent fuel are in dry casks, and how much is sitting in there?
I think there are about 10 casks.
I think the important point here is that there is fuel in the spent fuel pools in both units, and it will continue to be. In other words, the operating mode is not to take the fuel, because every time we go through another operation, we move fuel over to the spent fuel pool, and then there's a lot of reasons why you would want it to cool down for a while in the spent fuel pool before you're handling it.
Yeah, sure, but again, we've seen in Japan, they counted up between the six reactors, and all, there's like, I don't know, hundreds of thousands of these rods. If they need to be kept, I mean, they're in water, and the concerns is there's leaking, there's water. So to the extent they're in dry cast, that's, you know, even if they tip over, they're designed.
That's correct.
It's relatively safe. So if 40% of the spent fuel at any point were to be in dry cast, let's say today or by next week, then we're dealing with the other 60%. I'm just trying to get a sense of...
I'm honestly not prepared to get... Certainly we can give you that.
Okay.
There'll be a follow-up data when you know.
Okay. But would every rod you take out of the spent fuel pool for dry cast, that's one less rod that has to be cooled with water.
Right.
That's the point
we'll
I'm trying to get at.
And provide that to
okay.
You.
Right.
Okay. Thank you.
Why don't we just slow it in the...
You
done, Mr. Ken? Do you want...
I think we've...
Yeah, I think that covers the Mike is sort of my expert in the area of emergency planning. So if there were questions there, I think Mike would be the best one.
Oh, I don't. Do you want to, you have a statement, Mike?
I'd be happy to answer questions.
Oh, questions. Okay. If I might just prior to the chair, just ask a few, and then we'll go around so everybody has their chance to do it. The in light of Japan, is there no lesson that you've learned that you would integrate, change, make some suggested operational changes, backup systems. What are you seeing that how would you comment on that?
My comment will be there undoubtedly will be many lessons that we take from Japan.
Mm-hmm.
I think at this point, you know, with the absence of the detailed information that you would need to make those changes. Both NRC, the industry, and even INPO has said we're going to be studying this event very carefully. I have no doubt that there will be changes that we make in response to this event. But at this point, I'm not prepared to tell you what they might be, or even whether I think it's just too early to try and say that.
Many of the things I listened very carefully, sir, to what you were saying. Many of the things you appended were for shutdown, for appropriate shutdown, to go into a shutdown mode. What we're seeing in Japan was not the concern of the reactors themselves, correct? Three of them were being refueled. We're not in a hot stage anyway. And by all accounts, it seems that they were able to retract the rods and the other three into the reactor. It's been the spent fuel pools that have been the Achilles heel of what's going on. In light of both the volume of radiation, the nature of those rods that cannot be moved until at least usually about 5 years over to a non-mechanical cooling system, and that seems to be the Achilles then, the spent fuel pool. What are you considering? Are there any any additional backups that you're considering before you get to a SAMG? What is that? Are those people?
Severe accident management guidelines.
And those are people rushing in with water to try to...
Well, those are guidelines that the industry and the plant operators use to plan for various scenarios.
They're procedures.
They're procedures. And one of the procedures is to have the fire brigade take Hudson River water and other water to douse and continue to put
there,
in spent fuel.
There are
correct?
Procedures in the severe accident management guidelines that in the very, very unlikely event that we got to that point, which I don't believe we would ever expect to see. But those, in other words, the whole concept behind defense in depth is do everything humanly possible so that this never happens,
mm-hmm.
and then assume it does. So the whole purpose of the SAMG procedures is to say, it's happened. You take it off the table, whether it could or it couldn't, and then you develop the capability to be able to deal with it at that point. That's what those documents are.
Given that, from reactor fuel to cask fuel, what are you prepared today, and I guess the answer is no, to make any additional corrections, additional protection in depth, any changes to the spent fuel pools themselves?
Right. I think what we know today, is that this issue has been studied very carefully. You know, we looked at things even, as you may recall, a few years ago, we had the independent safety evaluation done at Indian Point, where we brought in a bunch of very independent individuals with a great deal of knowledge and background. And they looked, among other things, very carefully at this issue of spent fuel pool protection. And their conclusion, and our conclusion, up until we see something coming from Japan that would cause us to think differently, which to date we have not, is that we have the capability to adequately protect spent fuel at Indian Point, even in an event like this.
How do you test that? I mean, one could sit here and say you don't. Your mother wears army boots. I mean, you could just get into a he said, he said. What proof do we have that, in fact, that's the case? When we see that the ultimate backup is, again, the fire brigade to pour water on, that's not working very well in Japan. The power, they had diesel. That got, obviously, you talked about the fuel and you're not below ground. But what if, in fact, primary is out? What if, in fact, your diesels are impaired, or not even impaired for a long period of time, but act accordingly, but then at some point run out with the inability to go back to an AC network? What are you dealing with to keep water circulating over these fuel rods?
Well, again, the primary system for keeping the fuel in the spent fuel pool cool is its own cooling system. If that were to fail, the primary method of keeping the pool cool is to keep watering. I mean, it really is, strange as it may sound, that simple. Because what happens is the fuel heats. The fuel will cause the water to evaporate. As the water evaporates, it takes the heat out of the pool. The only problem is it takes some water out of the pool too. So the whole goal of keeping the spent fuel cool is to keep water in the pool. So, I mean, we have questions about why that was such a challenge for the Japanese, to be honest, that we don't know all the answers to. I can tell you, for instance, that you know, among the mitigating capabilities that we have at both of these units, we have diesel-driven fire pumps, which are capable of delivering a lot of fire water up to that spent fuel pool in the hoses stage to be able to bring it over there. We have backup diesels beyond that we can haul out where they're being stored in a safe location, by the way, from a terrorist attack, because that's what we're thinking about here. Is that somehow the terrorist attack makes it so that we have to bring this backup equipment into place. We have that capability. And so from everything we can see right now, it's hard to understand, honestly, why the Japanese had difficulty pulling the fuel. And until we know that, you know, I can't see what changes we would consider making.
Second question relates, and then I'll finish up, just with regards to the evacuation plan itself. The concern that a lot of constituents have voiced to me, and I'm sure to colleagues here, is the reality versus the plan. The reality in Japan is that the danger zone, the evacuation zone, from the Japanese perspective, when this incidents did occur and are occurring, was a 12.5-mile zone. I think they've evacuated about 200,000 people or so. And the United States government has urged United States citizens to evacuate up to the 50-mile zone. When you look to the geography of Westchester and you look to the planning that we have here in Westchester County, in fact, 50 miles would take us through down to Staten Island, Kingston in the north, obviously Nassau, Suffolk on the west, and into New Jersey on the east. A predicate to having a license is that you have a workable plan that FEMA and the NRC have, in fact, continue to certify. Obviously, we're going to work with NRC and our federal representatives here and try to get FEMA in, Mr. Chairman, to answer some of these questions in an unbiased, non-proprietary fashion. But when you look to even Mr. Slobin in your comments before the Congress on March 10th, 2003, and I'm quoting, "While it is possible, though extremely unlikely, that there could be a circumstance that could lead to a release related radioactivity into the environment, the distances from Indian Point to New York City Connecticut and New Jersey are such that radiation doses would be lower than the levels that could cause acute injury or illness. Any long-term health effects would be indistinguishable from normal background levels. In short, the citizens of Connecticut and New Jersey are not at risk from an accident at Indian Point. Given your testimony at that time to Congress, sir, do you change your point of view? And what have we learned from the incidents over in Japan regarding evacuation planning?
The situation, as far as I'm aware, in Japan, the direction made by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the guidance, was based on a very high degree of uncertainty involving 6 reactors and 6 fuel pools. NRC did a calculation, which they described as a hypothetical calculation, the details of which we do not know, that led them to that admittedly very conservative conclusion. Based on what we know, I believe that the information I gave in 2003 is still accurate.
Why would we believe you and not the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, though?
I think.
And the American our government over in Japan.
I don't think we're necessarily saying different things. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission did what they described as a hypothetical calculation, and also described it as very conservative. We don't know the nature of that calculation. But we do know our calculations, and we do know those that have been made by other experts, and we know actual empirical experience at places such as Three Mile Island and Chernobyl. The combination of what we know in terms of our design, our radioactive fission product inventory, coupled with empirical evidence, leads me to believe that what we said in 2003 is still the case today.
New York Times did a wonderful piece just a few days ago showing the array, the compass, the protractor of the 10 miles and the radiation and the tremendous dosage up to, about, I think it was about 18 to 20 miles, and then the trace dosage up to 50 miles. So they've been utilizing whatever information is available. If the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, through their deliberation, sir, does determine that 50 miles or something greater than 10 miles is in fact the evacuation zone, and needs to be planned for. Do you concede, sir, that in fact 50 miles would be an unworkable evacuation, that in fact the evacuation zone a suitable evacuation plan would not be in place for us here in the New York area, no comment to any place else in the country, and in fact as a predicate to the license would then imperil the very nuclear license itself?
I'm not prepared to speculate on what the NRC may or may not do. I'm sure the NRC will, after the experience in Pennsylvania at Three Mile Island, as they did with the international community after the experience at Chernobyl, do a very careful and thorough analysis. And once that is done, and they make their findings clear, obviously we will abide by their findings.
Sir, Mr. McKen, thank you, sir.
If I could add to that, I mean, again, it's we know about our reactor, we know about our fission product inventory. We know our experience from Three Mile Island. We don't, as I said before, have all the details on what happened in Japan. But if the NRC were to make that conclusion, and frankly, I don't know how many folks had an opportunity to watch the Executive Director for Operations brief the commission this morning. Mr. Borchardt, when he made that briefing, did not say the NRC was challenging the 10-mile emergency planning zone. But if they did, then it would become a condition of our license, and we would have to comply with that. And if that meant demonstrating an ability to perform evacuations beyond the 10-mile, we would have to do that. But again, I see no evidence that the NRC is likely to move in that direction. Time will tell.
One comment, and I'll turn it over to you and the legislators, of course. The last comment I think that I learned, and as legislators we need to challenge, is that we clearly have a role to play, our government, our home legislators here, other counties as well, and that if in fact there is an occurrence, having the transparency, the knowledge, the objectivity of government representatives and government agencies, even beyond the industry, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, to elected officials, to others, and to regulatory, is appropriate and important, and that we saw that in Japan when the proprietor of the plant itself tried to take certain actions in that difficult phase and even beyond without the appropriate the Japanese government authority stepping in, that it didn't create the best situation, and probably some things did not occur that should have, and vice versa. So it's important that we recognize, and a gentle chiding, if I may, because I was here, and one of the few, I think the only legislator that was here, after the February 15th, 2000 incident, where it was quite clear at that time, and Entergy admitted, and we all worked hard to try to make sure that wouldn't happen again, that there were not the proper notifications, and the emergency service entities were not brought in early enough on that particular issue. And so, you know, as Earl Weaver said, I argue the call not to get this one changed, but to make sure the next one doesn't. You know, just again, put it on the record that the authorities, even beyond the NRC, have an appropriate role to play, and it would be important. And this is to underscore that we're on the scene, as our state and other governments are as well.
Thank you. Theobald, sir. I believe the incident you're referring to may be prior to our ownership, but in any case, you know, we do daily, we have drills and exercises. We work very closely with both local first responders, state and local governments, and we take absolutely seriously our responsibility to both provide information and notification. We've tried to utilize technology to allow people to receive information about an Indian Point or an emergency in the way they would like to receive it, whether they'd like to be notified electronically or in other ways. So it's a responsibility we take very seriously. The independent safety assessment evaluation that Mr. McCann referred to was something that we did on our own, not without encouragement from our elected officials, but brought in a panel of blue ribbon experts. And again, one of the things that we discussed was the idea of closer collaboration and transparency in the area of emergency planning. So we've tried to carry out that mandate, and we fully expect to continue to do so.
Thank you. Legislators, questions? Yeah.
Mr. Chairman. Mr. Burton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Legislator Testa and I live not very many miles from the facility, and while we may have somewhat different views on the desirability of having the plant in our neighborhood, I think we're united in the fact that we care very much about the people who live very close, within the 10-mile zone, within the 5-mile zone. He certainly does. I come real close. The concern,
and a half miles
on legislative test.
The concern that I have, and I won't speak for Mr. Test at all, but the concern that I have, and for my constituents, is the swirling nature of the winds make an arbitrary distance seem to me to be somewhat meaningless. And my family and I have decided that we're going to do a shelter in place solution to any incident that comes along if we have any sort of decent warning. The question that I guess that I have is of those people across the river who were in within the 5-mile zone, all of us, I think, have a not unreasonable fear of not being warned soon enough. And while I'm glad, I've been really quite gratified at the response to the siren testing and that sort of thing. Is there more that you envision being able to do for those of us who are so close and are frankly going to be unable to get out under a situation? Because as soon as the siren goes off, I jump in my car and I'll be in gridlock on 9A before the things start. So, how can you give us some assurances that, in fact, our knowledge of this would be sooner rather than later, to enable us to implement whatever we're going to do?
We are concerned, as are you, about the quality and timeliness of notification. And to that end, we have been working with the four counties, Westchester, Rockland, Putnam, and Orange, to improve that notification system, and have done several upgrades to it. We are going beyond that to install in the near future a highly automated, very fast notification. We've recently tested it and found that we can make notifications within 30 seconds. So, and those would be notifications to government authorities. Government authorities, such as in the case of Westchester Emergency Services, then take action based on their readiness to notify the public. I think in New York, we have a very unique capability in the form of a product called NY Alert, which the state of New York has put in place that allows notifications to members of the public by a variety of means, means that are customized and tailored to your specific interests and needs. So, for example, NY Alert can notify you by your cell phone, by a pager, by email, by a text message, over the internet, through radio and television. That kind of notification capability is not very common in the United States. In fact, I'm only aware of it being in place elsewhere in California. So that's very useful because, unlike sirens, which only tell you to pay attention, the NY Alert has the capability of not only waking you up, if you will, but also delivering to you the context message that tells you what is exactly going on and what you need to do as an individual to protect yourselves. And indeed, depending on where you live, as you say, sheltering in place may be the most prudent action. Evacuation is not always necessary, but when it is, we would make recommendations to the county in this case. And the county's then having the advantage of a very sophisticated and detailed evacuation plan would be able to implement those for the areas that are likely to be affected in an order that is designed to optimize the speed for evacuation. But they're not limited to evacuation. Sheltering is a very effective method. And it really depends on what's going on with the wind. Some places would be unaffected. Others would clearly be in areas of concern. That's one of the things that we consider and the county considers when it makes directions for evacuation if those are necessary.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
The other thing, you know, it's interesting you mention that, but I'm sure most of us follow the news pretty closely through the event. And one thing that was sort of a very interesting outcome was the effect of the social media on notification capability in Japan. It would be interesting to see what the studies come out with in this regard, but it appears that the word spread, particularly with respect to the tsunami, in seconds, in ways that may actually have helped people get to high ground and save their own lives.
And to members of the committee, if possible, I know, you know, we called this meeting to specifically focus, obviously, what's going on in Japan, and you know, a lot of time for lessons learned, but compare the earthquake, the storage pools. We can ask lots of questions about the evacuation, things that have been in place for a long time, and maybe our committees will, over time, pursue a lot of these issues. But I just would, because we could be here for hours going through a lot of stuff. So to the extent you have questions, I request that you kind of keep in the focus of, you know, what's been happening in the current events and in that way. Thank you, Mr. Harkin.
Thank you, both chairs, and thank you for being here. As one official, I appreciate your outreach efforts. I know you've got your quarterly update meetings that I and others have been invited to. So, you know, even if there are areas where we don't always agree, it's good that we have an open and frank dialogue. So thank you for that. To your point, I do have a question, but I do want to make a quick point because you gentlemen had shared the lessons you learned from from Three Mile Island. I would like to share with you lessons that I learned from Three Mile Island. I probably have the distinction of being the only legislator involved in a nuclear evacuation, but I was evacuated from the Three Mile Island area with a much less dense population, and I can just tell you it didn't work. Admittedly, they didn't have planning in place the way it's done now, but Route 80, Route 81 backed up for miles. It took us well over 4 hours to go a very short distance. So when I hear about evacuations, whether it's 10 miles or 50 miles, I personally don't have a lot of confidence. That's not a reflection on you or the fine people in the county working on it. It's just the reality of trying to funnel, you know, 500,000 people into a funnel this big. I just wanted to put that on the record. The other thing I think the taxpayers should know is that Westchester County spends over $3 million a year on emergency preparedness directly related to the Indian Point nuclear facility. I know you pay some money into the four-county fund, but it is really insignificant to the cost that we and the other counties have. And just as one legislator who hears a lot about taxes, I would love to see you step up and offer to pick up more of that cost. The question I have, the statement I heard that a lot of this about was dealing with conditions you would never expect to see. But in Japan, those were conditions they never expected to see an earthquake that big or a tsunami. So going back to the chairman's point, doesn't that change your thinking about your manuals, about your planning? For instance, you know, you're pretty low to the Hudson River. That's a tidal basin. You know, could you not expect to see, if not a tsunami, a major tidal surge that could have some impact? You know, what is there some seismic activity beyond what you've designed for? And again, I'm not trying to be hysterical here, but in terms of, you know, let's prepare for the worst and hope for the best, to that point of conditions we would never expect to see, you know, doesn't that change your thinking, at least in your planning or your forethought?
Yes, I appreciate the question. Maybe I didn't say it right, but when I said we never expect to see it, what that means is that our understanding of the laws of probability, how you apply historical information to make any guess about what might happen in the future, all that tells us that we should not see this event. That being said, as I responded to the chairman's question, we say, okay, that's fine, plan for it anyway. And so in that sense, we plan to address what we don't expect to see. And that's where we move into these severe accident management guidelines. That's where we move into staging all of this equipment that we really, from the laws of probability, never expect to have to use. But if we do, we are trained, staged, organized to be able to implement those plans for what we never expect to see. In terms of the earthquake, in terms of the flooding, again, the best science says you go back and look at what all the historical records tell you is the worst that could happen, and then you add a factor or a margin of safety on top of that, and you make that your design standard. So I'll just take this opportunity to address a question that didn't come up, but I'm sure is on people's minds, and that has to do with the report of an NRC report that basically indicated that the seismic conditions at Indian Point make it one of the riskiest plants. That is not what the NRC said, and it's certainly not what I believe to be true. I mean, if you think about it, it just makes no sense that a plant in an area like where our plant is would be a high-risk earthquake plant compared to others. So, you know, even if you look at that report, and the NRC has to some degree rebutted it, what they said is, hey, we made measurements on earthquake data, which they do, I believe, every 5 years or so, 5 or 6 years, that looks like the numbers are higher than what we had said before. So what does that mean? And they looked at some plants that they said, well, you know, you need to go back and look at that. But I'll ask you to think about this. When you evaluate that information, you really need to know two things. You need to know what's the change in the earthquake data and what are the systems that it is going to affect. So what the NRC has not yet done, and what we are in the process of doing, is overlaying that new earthquake information on our design, on our systems that are going to that need to survive an earthquake, and making an evaluation is current design still accurate? We absolutely believe it is.
Ms. McCann, the reason we didn't ask you that question was you earlier on conceded you were not a seismic expert. And so we are going to, as I think indicated, have the NRC and we're trying to get representatives in the seismic community who can come in and can give us some expert testimony in regard to what's been said. So while we appreciate your thoughts on that, by all admission, it is your thoughts. So we will to the committee bore in on that. No pun intended at all. Bore in on that particular issue and. Try to get to the bottom of, because that's a troubling report, and one that whether you live 1 mile or 50 miles or more, need to, I won't say get to the bottom of, but we need to, again, figure out what that really means.
I would certainly encourage you to get the facts on that, because
it's important.
My thoughts are that will really bear me out.
Yeah,
I'll just follow up on Mr. Burton, if I may. No, I thought that Gordon
is. Okay. He's from the office.
As someone who was the mayor of a bordering town, I participated in quite a few dry simulations, and I can tell you that Entergy does an outstanding job of informing and having a series of steps that they take with the county as well as the four counties they mentioned to inform all communities of what is going on, and the wind obviously plays a big part of that. I've been reading that out of Japan. It's going to be hard for you for a while to do any assessment because a lot of the reports are based on incorrect or false information. So it's going to take a while to get that information in a way where you can actually digest it and use it in a meaningful way. So it's kind of early for that, I would think. And as well as the perfect storm of a 9.0 earthquake with a 30-foot tsunami to wipe out the backup generators, I don't foresee that happening really in our area as well. So I just want to ratchet down a little of the fear that seems to be building up around here to play on the fears of people, whether we want to or not. I think it's time to make people realize, as I think you have done today, that your planning and what you are doing and will continue to do is in the best way that's possible and in the best interest of the people living in the area that I represent. So I remember when I was mayor, there was a dry cask. When that first came out, I know there was some concerns about that. There was a video that shows how that's done. Do you still have that available?
I believe we do. I obviously don't have it with me.
Right, no. Maybe if some people were able to watch that, they would feel a little bit more comfortable about that process. That's it. Sure. Thanks.
All right, thank you. Mr. Nona.
Thank you very much for appearing here today and sharing your thoughts to us. And I think it's important, as Legislator Testa said, to get the facts on the table and not let fears magnify themselves. On the dry cast issue, are you all familiar with the Lamont Doherty report and the projection, their thoughts that the 6 or 7 Richter scale earthquake in the region? And I think you said the plan is designed for a 6 Richter scale level. The dry cast, have you looked into, or is there can they withstand a 7 Richter scale earthquake, the dry cast?
The dry casts are required to have the same design basis earthquake capability as the site. So when we evaluate the revised NRC numbers, we'll be doing those for the dry cast as well. And again, all initial indications are that we should be fine.
But you'll be looking at that issue.
Yes, sir, absolutely.
And we'll find out the results.
Dry cast storage is definitely what we call a seismic design capability.
You pointed out that the two plants, the Fukushima plant, is boiling water and the Indian Point is pressurized. Are the cooling systems the same?
No.
I think we got to the point where there was a difference in the cooling
system. Yeah, I think fundamentally the difference is in the fact that cooling it at Indian Point is through the steam generators. Cooling in the Mark I design, and I'm more of a pressurized water guy, in the Mark I design, there is no primary and secondary system. The reactor is in essentially like something. It's like the steam generator. The steam comes directly from the reactor, which is in a containment structure. And the way that is cooled is you inject water into the reactor system itself, and you cool that water in a structure called the suppression pool, which is a large body of water in a sort of donut-shaped structure below the at the bottom of the containment that has enough water in it to be able to absorb the energy. So the way you eventually wind up providing longer-term cooling is you're pumping water into what would be essentially the containment structure, and then pumping that water into the reactor and then back into the containment structure and cooling it.
So it's a different system.
It's a different system.
I've had a number of questions from constituents. I've asked two of them. One is not quite related to what happened in Japan, but seemed to me to be a good question, and the other is related to what happened in Japan, but maybe very difficult to answer. One constituent had a concern, and this is based upon an article that appeared a while ago regarding Iran's attempt to gain nuclear capability. Are you prepared for any type of cyber attack?
Yes, sir. As you probably know, the NRC has recently begun rulemaking in the area of cyber attack. we will have some very specific things that we have to do. It's patterned on those things that the federal government does to protect their cyber capabilities, and it will be, you know, obviously it's a security area, but so I can't go into a lot of detail.
Sure.
But cybersecurity, certainly after the Stuxnet issue, where, you know, Iran experienced kind of a very effective cyber attack. That's a very real issue in our industry. It's being taken very seriously, and FTG has a very robust program that's looking at that, which we are required to do by our regulator.
One more question, and this was asked by a constituent that really did. I don't know if you can answer this question, but I thought it was an interesting question. And this constituent was reading the article about the Fukushima 50 and these people that stayed behind to, you know, who knows, but maybe sacrificed their lives. I mean, do you think we have people that you employ that would do that? I mean, I this person questioned whether we had people in the United States to do that, thought maybe it was just part of the Japanese culture that you'd have people that do that.
But
you know, if you have a disaster, you may need people to stay behind and deal with the problem who put themselves at risk.
Right. Well, first of all, again, I think it is too early to know what the health impact on those individuals has been. I will say this, that in the United States, we anticipate that in an accident, people may need to experience greater doses or exposures to radiation. We have the ability to extend the limit, but not to the point that it would make a person's life become a threat.
Thank you very much. That's all the questions.
I just said, in addition, realize this is cancelable, it's modest, but you know there are significant presence in our workforce of ex-military, Navy. Mr. Slobodin here, who's the director of emergency planning, was on the NRC team at the time, and I believe responded at Three Mile Island. So these operators and employees take their responsibilities quite seriously, but ultimately, we're looking to protect both the workers and the public.
Thank you.
Legislator Sipsky.
Thank you. Thank you for coming today. I'd like to follow up on a point that Legislator Nona brought up. If there are suggestions that a seismic event on 7 on the Richter scale is not outside the realm of possibility for this area, have you begun to give any thought to what might be done to better protect both the reactors and the fuel pools in the event that the design basis of 6 might not quite be good enough?
Yeah, I think the way I would answer that is that the NRC, with the latest geological seismic data that they have taken this as what's called a generic issue in the industry. We will be responding to that generic issue as will every other nuclear plant. The data that we are seeing so far maybe would not corroborate that. In fact, without getting too deep into an area in which I'm not an expert, but one of the issues that you have to consider is not only the magnitude, if you will, of the movement of the Earth, but also the rate at which the Earth is moving. And the reason for that, in simple engineering terms, is that structures respond to different frequencies differently. So what's interesting about the results that we've gotten from the NRC so far is that although there have been increases in the seismic spectra at the higher frequencies, we're also seeing that there are decreases in the seismic spectra at the lower frequencies. And it turns out that most of the structures that are really important, like the containment structure, like the big buildings, respond more to the lower frequencies. So when it's all said and done, and we've had a chance to really go through and let the experts complete the analysis, it's quite possible that we'll find that these revised results actually demonstrate that we have more margin with respect to the postulated drug points. But that work needs to be done by the experts.
Okay. Legislator Williams, any questions?
Not at this time.
Okay. Legislator Marcotte?
No, I'm good. Thanks.
Okay. Judy?
Just one, and I'm not sure if, and please feel free, thank you for coming, but feel free to tell me if this is not something you're prepared to answer, but I've read so many different reports, especially lately, about what percentage of Westchester County's power is actually coming from Indian Point, and what would be the case if we were not to receive power from Indian Point. Are you prepared to speak about that at all today?
You're probably much better.
What I would say is that the reactors produce about 2,000 megawatts, which is roughly enough power to power 2 million homes. The actual calculations of what percentage it is of the power in this region, which is would not just be Westchester but also New York City, varies depending on what the load is and the time of year. So that number may vary from 18 to as much as 38%. If you would think of it intuitively, on the back of an envelope, in the summer when the load is high, 2,000 would be a much smaller percentage of what the demand is. Whereas in winter, where the demand is lower, then it would obviously make up a much larger percentage. And the way it works basically is the generators are on, the load has to be matched. There's an independent system operator who does that. And so, but those are the rough calculations. I believe, I don't have it with me, but we'll get back to you. There's a calculation that was done recently that just ran the number of kilowatt hours over a period of time, and then how much time Indian Point generators, what their output was during that time, and that gives you a sort of simple calculation to say what it is.
And just a follow-up to that, if I may, how much is sold elsewhere on the grid? I mean, is there a way to say how much of what's generated here goes elsewhere?
We're wholesalers, and we sell it back. We sell this power back to your utility, to Con Edison, and to the New York Power Authority, which provides municipal power and government power. Basically, what I would tell you is if you look at the load patterns and the other distribution, the move is usually south, not north. So most of the power is used in this corridor, this southeast corridor, where there is a very high demand.
Thank you.
Ms. Myers, perfect sequitur to wrapping up this meeting. We are going to have, as the Environment and Energy Committee, as appropriately so, a series of meetings on this very issue. Mr. Clary did some seminal work on some of this research, and the most recent statistics we saw, it's about 12% of the state of New York in terms of power. And if you realize peak is about 34,000 to 35,000 megawatt on a daily basis in the worst of July 2000, you could do your math over that. So either way, we will
have a state load. I was really focusing more on a regional
right, and there are a lot of numbers that we can talk about. So we're going to talk about that, the whole issue of this board and its resolutions in the past. We're going to bring back relative to possibly reusing the site to try to make sure that the power, the jobs, and the taxes are continued to be replaced with a non-nuclear Indian Point and the opportunities therein. But next Monday at 3:00, we're endeavoring to, as I said before, to members move. The issue of seismic activity and respect to you, sir. Thank you for your thoughts on that, of course, but try to bore in on that. We're going to try with our federal representatives here doing very good work for us, try to help line up some NRC, some FEMA representatives. Mr. Sutton has been here on the evacuation planning, our good colleague here. Mr. Rogowski will continue to deal with the issue of particularly the public safety component of it. But I thank you, gentlemen, for being here today. Thank legislators for the opportunity to, and Mr. Rogowski is going to close. This is just the pre-close. I'm the prologue, if you will, or the prelogue. And we'll have an opportunity to continue this discussion. So it's fact-finding, plan, not panic. Workers' protections are critical, and we will continue this discussion next Monday at 3:00.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One final substantive question. When Indian Point was built, I don't know how much was taken into account in terms of on-site storage of spent fuel rods. The plan was not to be doing that. So the design criteria for the pools of spent fuel, are they, in fact, been designed to the same type of seismic protection? Because they were not probably part of your initial license.
Yes, sir. Well, the idea of storing spent fuel in those pools was always part of the original
design. Was it? Okay.
And so,
but you've been racking them a lot more than I... Well, anyway, what's the design? The question is the design.
The design has been seismic from the beginning.
Okay. To the colleagues, again, you know, well, one comment, a former business colleague of mine worked at Westinghouse and was sent into Three Mile Island for 90 seconds at a time, and he died of leukemia, so just for the record, so that I eventually caught up to even 90 seconds. One of the goals today was to point out the differences from the point of view of the public, differences in seismology, you know, the geologic formation, so different types of earthquakes really based on geology. We really shouldn't be seeing that nine based on the geologies. I understand the cooling systems are different. Backup electricity is different. And to, I guess the question, going to the future, here you, we have Representative Entergy here, whereas Wall Street sort of killed nuclear power for the last 30 years, you fellows are in the business. Do you have any plans in the foreseeable future to be building any more nuclear power plants, or is Wall Street, last plan I saw was estimated the $8 billion, and they're being stopped in Georgia. So do you have any plans to do any building in nuclear?
We are not building anything now. I think it would be unrealistic to think that these events will not have some impact on the business. I think, you know, time will tell as to what that impact is.
Okay. Again, thank you on behalf of the safety committee. Thank you for coming. We appreciate it.
Thanks.
I'll enter motion adjourned for both committees.
Judy.
Second by
John Fester.
Judy Myers, all in favor.
Yep.
Aye.
We stand adjourned.
John Donna.
Yeah, good job.
Good, how are you?
I don't blame you.
Yeah, good.
Doesn't matter.